I feel that I've got to respond in part to what Dr. Wolf was just saying with a definition, which I think may be what he's coming to tomorrow. And I'm always hesitant to branch into a new thought that may be stealing some thunder where he wants to go. But nonetheless, I hate to do this when he isn't here, but I guess I'm going to have to. It's this word stipulation. There is a certain amount of ambivalence in what Dr. Wolf was saying this morning, which results from a confusing of the concept of something which is conditional and something which is purely promissory. I'm telling you this as a lawyer now, not as a theologian. And either one of these things can be quite properly termed a stipulation. Because I can stipulate by expressing myself by words or acts or some way else. Thank you very much. I can put into words some different ideas which make eventualities depend upon them. And there is a marked difference between words of condition, pure condition, and words which are promissory, where if I do not keep the promise, certain consequences will not follow. Let me illustrate this very quickly, because this is not what I want to talk about this morning at all. I'm simply so concerned that those of you who were here at the first hour and heard Dr. Wolf are going to be confused for life, unless I get you straightened out right away. I've got to take a couple minutes to do this. Let's take a very simple illustration of a man who sees a hobo or a beggar out on the street, and he says, "It's snowing, it's cold, it's like Minnesota," something of that sort. And he sees this this poor old guy out there in the street just shivering and shuddering, terrible. And so the man says to the thief, "If you will walk to the clothing store with me, I will buy you a new overcoat." You got these words: stipulation, promise, condition. If you go to the store with me, I will buy you a coat. Now you see, Dr. Wolf this morning was suggesting to you that there were kinds of covenants in which God says to his people, if you are faithful, if you abide in me, then I will bless you with my blessings. And he was saying, well, these are stipulations. And although he is basically trying to set up two forms for us, one of a promissory covenant, you've got to earn your right to my grace, over here in this line he was discussing this morning, and the other one, which is pure gift. But he says that I'm confused by this, because even in the pure gift there are stipulations. For those of you who are not here, go back and read Psalm 89, verses 23 to 33 or thereabouts, and you will see these stipulations coming up. But look, my friends, if you go to the store with me, I will buy you a coat. Is this language up there a stipulation? Sure, it's a stipulation. Now that you've said it's a stipulation, you haven't said a thing yet, because you don't know whether it's the kind of stipulation which says, if you will give me something going to the store as a bargain for exchange for the coat, as a price for the coat, then in return for this price I will give you the coat, which is a bargain, which is a sale. I want to see you walk over to that store so much, and you don't want to walk over to that store at all. But if you will walk over to that store as a price as labor, as working for me, as a bargain for exchange, then I'll sell you a coat in payment for what you've done. If you've done that, you've got a promise for a promise, a bargain for exchange. On the other hand, if you say that if you go to the store is simply a condition, it isn't the price at all, but it is simply a condition, not a promise that I'm asking you to make. But it's, look, I want to give you a coat. I want to make you a gift of a coat. But I can't make you a gift of a coat here because I don't have a coat. We aren't in the store. I don't know what your size is and all of these sort of things. But if you will make it possible for me to make a gift of this coat to you by going to the store with me on this condition, then I will give you this overcoat. Not that you've earned it. Not that I'm saying that I will give it to you because I want to see you walk through the snow that night. But it's if you will make it possible for me to do this, then you give it as a gift. Now, one can never breach in the sense of failing to perform a promise and therefore be in default, therefore be a debtor, therefore be a malefactor who disqualifies himself from the gift. One can never be that kind of a loser in a promise which is on condition, where the condition is not promissory. And so God, even in Psalm 89, doesn't say to the people, if you will do this and if you will do this as a return for my grace, then I will give it to you. That's not what he's saying. You can't breach that kind of a condition, a stipulation which is only a condition. You can only fail to perform, breach promises. Conditions are things which happen or don't happen. I want to make a gift to you, but I can't make this gift to you unless certain circumstances, certain conditions, you see, circumstances, conditions, certain environments exist, certain willingness on your part. I want you to be my people, but you cannot be my people unless a certain relationship exists between us. And I am not going to force that relationship upon you. But if that relationship exists, if you will go to the store with me, if you will make it possible, if I have your presence at the store, then I will complete this gift. If you do not, then I cannot make the gift to you, because God is not a God of coercion. God is a God of grace, a God that gives. And so the answer to Dr. Wolf's question, can there ever come a time when Israel loses the promise of the covenant by disassociation, the non-occurrence of the conditions which are precedent to the effectiveness of God's gift? The answer is yes. But not because Israel is in breach on promise, because Israel is not buying its salvation. Rather, it's because God has said, I will not jam this down your throat. I will give it to you only on these stipulations, these conditions, under these circumstances. That's the only way that it is possible for you to receive it, because it's only under those circumstances the gift will be completed. Now, he derailed me on that one. I hate the thought of trying to spend all afternoon straightening out Umha Wolf.
Could you transfer this to the New Testament and say, if you believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, thou shalt be saved?
Yes.
Exactly the same thing.
Exactly the same thing. On the condition that you believe, that you become, that you believe, you see, this faith. On that condition, then it works. But if you will not, then it won't work. Yesterday, I was illustrating exactly this same thing, and let me do it once more. Although this is not what I wanted to do either. But it's got to be done at this point. I didn't think that you were strong enough to take this on Wednesday.
But that was going to happen on Thursday.
You remember we were discussing both Monday and Tuesday the concept of how God's grace works, and I was using the triangle with the cognitive dissonance. You remember this? If nothing else, this is going to run out your ears before I go. Which, shall we say, yes, let's use the same one so we don't upset things forever and ever.
Peace, U.S., and Vietnam, I believe, was the illustration we had used.
And we were saying that if we like peace, they don't like peace, therefore we don't like them, and our mathematics is
negative times, positive times, negative equals negative.
And we were saying in God's grace, which is the way that God conforms us, transforms us, converts us, actually changes us, that if things are not as we have perceived them to be, we either have to change our perception or else deny what we know is inevitably true. Now, if God can change, if we can change from Vietnam, that sign, and prove to them that we really love them, so it's positive times positive, they're going to have to be converted. This, of course, is familiar to you from the last 2 days, I trust. And the illustration that I use specifically, which now, be strong, friends, because I think you can understand what I'm trying to get at now. I use this illustration. I believe that this is a piece of bark. It looks like a piece of bark as I examine it and drop it and break it. And I'm now persuaded, my perception of this is that it is a piece of bark. I think it's a piece of bark. That's my belief. And you over here are saying that it is not a piece of bark. And therefore, you and I are in sharp disagreement as to whether or not this is a piece of bark. Now, if you want to try and convert my whole attitude about this thing, you prove to me by chemical tests, by the laboratory process, that this is really made of plastic. See, it's an awfully good job. It looks so much like bark that it really took me in. But you can demonstrate to me scientifically that that is, in fact, plastic. And you are right and I am wrong. Now, I put the sign in the wrong place to start with. You prove to me that you are right and that I am wrong, like that. Therefore, if you can really prove to me, scientifically, that that is a plastic, I'm going to have to agree with you. And your attitude and my attitude will be in harmony. And then this is what God does to me, you see. I say God has every right in the world to punish me because I had disobeyed his command. And I rush into the assumption that this is sin, when it's really not sin at all. The disobedience of the command is not the concept of sin. So I say God's going to come down and punish me because this is a God who deals with me in law. He will do what is proper and just. He will punish me for the disobedience of my sin. Instead, God comes to me in love, and he sacrifices himself for me. He gives his son for me. And I look at this, and this is so completely different from what I expected. My cognition, my perception of what's going to happen is so basically untrue compared to the facts of what I in fact see happening. God was supposed to punish me, he didn't, he came down to love me and sacrificed himself for me. That I am completely upset in this thing and I have to change my attitude toward God. Why doesn't that work in life everywhere? Well, the reason for it is that I don't have to examine that bark. You see, I can refuse to examine that bark. I can say that's bark, and you can't make me examine. I won't look at it. I won't listen to your evidence. I shut my ears and I close my eyes. And Scripture says this time after time after time. When it says you've got ears and you've got eyes, but you won't listen, you won't hear. You won't see. You won't use your ears. You won't use your eyes. The evidence of God comes whelming in upon us, but we refuse to look at it. And if you won't look at the evidence, you never realize that you're wrong. Now, why doesn't God grab you by the throat and shake you and say, look, you rascal, I am going to make you sit down and examine that bark? The very basic reason that God created me as a free being, and he will not violate my personality by coercion, because coercion becomes a violation of the independence and freedom and the sovereignty which God gave me in creation. God will not violate my person. God gives me free choice. God floods me with the evidence of his love, but he doesn't make me see it. He gives me the opportunity to see it. He gives me the eyes. He gives me the ears. He gives me the evidence to see it, but he won't He won't make me see it. He won't compel me. Does that make any sense to you at all? Or was I right in my first judgment? You're not ready for that yet.
you go think about that for a while.
And tomorrow I'll hit you with that one again when you're stronger. Now, if I can say what I intended to say this morning, to get us into this thing in a little bit more orderly fashion, let's start with what Pastor Nelson said last night in Devotions Chapel. See, he's dead right now. That the Christian who, the man who says that he is a Christian and then withdraws himself completely from the activities of the world around him, who doesn't see the poverty in the world, who doesn't see the hideous lack of charity in the way that the Negro is treated in the United States today, who doesn't see these things you see in the world, is not acting in a way that a Christian would act at all. He has insulated himself. What good is salt if it has lost its savor? What good is the light if you put it under the bushel basket so it's hidden and doesn't light anyone's step? Christianity is light, and it is salt, and it is yeast, and if it has lost this permeating quality which relates us in love over to other people, of what value is it? I mean, if we aren't radiating, we simply are not Christians. We aren't involved in the world, and we must be involved in the world. It's dead right. Now the question is, how do you do it? Well, I've tried so far to set up this pattern of God's love, this Romans 12 cognitive balance, and I trust that is coming through a little bit. That's one way of doing it, and just now I have tried to tell you why that is not good for all circumstances and all conditions. And the reason that it's not good for all circumstances and all conditions is that the other guy is not always willing to listen, to see, to accept it. That's God's grace, you see. We can reject God's grace. And this is true in life, too. Insofar as it lies with you, live peaceably with all the world. Insofar as it's within your control, to live with another man peaceably, to relate yourself to him in love. Insofar as that's dependent upon you, do it. But if the other man will not accept, then how do you live with him? Well, that's not such a tough question. Listen, insofar as it is God's will, God would live with me and have me live with him in perfect harmony, in perfect relationship, without these disparities. God is true and faithful and loyal, and he will not be swerved. His covenant is everlasting. He will never change. The love comes trickling down all the time, not only at Holden, but everywhere else. And I don't have to take it. I don't have to accept it. I've just said God will not force it upon me. Now, if I will not live that way with God, then how shall God relate himself to me? God will relate himself to me in the most orderly and loving fashion that he can, without violating my person. He will flood me with gifts. He will give me food. He will give me water. He will give me sunshine and air, trees. He will give me the things that I need to live, not because I've earned them or merited them, but because God causes his rain to fall on the just and the unjust alike. And I can take these things and I can use them in my life, and I will exercise my dominion over them that God gave me to exercise. And this is to be primarily a matter of my head. This is the way that I look at water and I look at air, and I wonder how to use it. Now the relationship that unites me and God, or that holds me in tension to God as an unredeemed person, or as a person who is now rejecting God's grace, is not a relationship of redemption or salvation, but it's a relationship of law. It's a relationship of rules. That's the way that God relates himself to me when I will not accept his grace. When you and I cannot, as brothers in complete love, sit down and resolve all of our relationships and our problems by love, then it is necessary, in order to survive, that we have another kind of relationship, and that relationship is one of law. Now the danger here, my friends, is that we automatically go the cheap and easy way and say that God's law is his will for me, that he means me to live a lawful relationship. And he does not. It is not God's will that I live according to his laws. That's poverty stuff. It is God's will that I live according to his grace, and that I accept his salvation, and I unite myself with him in this way. And if I won't do it, if I can't accept it, if I'm unable to live this way, then God blesses me with his rules, with his law, with this other system over there. So yesterday, I was trying very hard to illustrate to you that sin, is not the violation of God's laws or his rules, but rather that sin is alienation. Being a child of God, being a child of God is a question of one's status. You either are or you aren't. Doing what the rules say is a question of behavior. And there is all the difference in the world between a problem of status, being, and performing, doing. I'll illustrate that for you, if I may. You get this animal out there that I see around occasionally, running around the yard. He looks like a dog, barks like a dog, walks like a dog, he's got hair like a dog, chases squirrels like a dog. As far as I can determine, he is a dog, or she, as the case may be. That is a dog. Most dogs do certain things. They do have fleas, chase squirrels, bark at cats, and so forth. When one is in this status, he automatically does more or less of all the standard things that a person in that category or that status does. When one is a Christian, he does more or less all of those things that Christians do. Chase squirrels, have fleas. These things are part and parcel of the very status, the very type of existence that you have. But just because you see an animal that chases squirrels, you don't know that you've got a dog. It might be a cat, it might be a cougar, it might be something else. Just because you see an animal that has fleas, you don't know that you've got a dog. The status is not the same thing as the behavior. Now, if you see a man who loves his wife, who loves his children, who is concerned about the freedom of human beings in the world, who is red hot on civil rights, who is very sensitive about the prerogatives of human beings, who gives away most of his money, he's doing a lot of things that make him look like a Christian. Is he a Christian? Just because he's got fleas, chases squirrels, barks, doesn't mean that he's a dog. There are animals that are more efficient at chasing squirrels than dogs are. There can be in this world people who are more generous, who exhibit in their life a better performance on the utility rules than you do, and still not be a Christian. When one says to oneself, how can it be that this man looks like a Christian, talks like a Christian, acts like a Christian, and still denies that he is a Christian? Is it possible that someone else can do the works of the law and not be a Christian? The answer to that is yes, 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 yes. Because this is a matter of utility. It's a matter of measuring the efficiency of things. It's a matter of figuring out how many feet you can force water through a pipe without having so much friction that you won't get any at the other end. And there is no reason in the world why the Mohammedan or the Jew or the Zambagi, if there is such a thing, or whatever you've got, there's no reason why this guy's head, why his perception of what is going on in the world around him can't be just as good as yours. If your relationship to God is not a relationship of status, if it isn't that you are a child of God, but if you are trying to relate yourself to God by what you do, if you are trying to demonstrate that you are entitled to heaven because you've collected all the green stamps that you need, because you've given away half of your wealth, because you haven't hated people, you're working on the wrong end of this thing. You're working on a behavioral problem, not a status problem. Sin is not a behavioral problem. Sin is not what occurs when you violate a rule. That may be stupid, and you may be sorry. I hereby, without my shoes on and with my bare toe sticking out, repeal the law of gravity. It isn't going to work. I'm going to have a sore toe. But I can do this, you see. It's stupid. It's stupid. But I can do it. The other thing is a question of status. And this is what Dr. Wolf was talking about also this morning when he says that when one will permit God, God adopts him into the family. And this is a matter of status. It is a matter of being the child of God. It's a matter of being. Now, when one is a dog, he probably, the odds are, as a dog, the odds are that he will chase squirrels, have fleas, and do all the other things. When one is a Christian, the odds are that he will do all of those things which the rules prescribe. The odds are. Not that all dogs behave the same. But the fact that you've got one psychotic dog out here who won't chase squirrels doesn't mean that he isn't a dog. He still is a dog, you see. And the fact that I am one warped Christian and I don't keep one of the rules, I fudge, I cheat. See, I don't do it according to the rule book. The fact that I violate a rule doesn't mean that I'm no longer a dog. I'm just a non-squirrel chasing dog. But if it comes to the place where I deny my very status, where I say to God, I disadopt myself, I disassociate myself from you, I will no longer be your son, then the status itself is gone. In the very practical world, which is the only world there is, and that means that it includes the love of God as well as the observance of the rules, these things are never separated. You cannot say that there are two worlds. I am not a two kingdoms man. I do not see that there is such a thing as this is my theological life, and this is the life where I go out and rob widows and children to make a living. These two worlds are one world. I am one man. There isn't any other place where I can meet God than right here. Today, there isn't any other way that I can treat you except either in this status or not in that status. But because God, in converting me, and I'm sure that he has authorized me to be a little God and to try and convert other people, transform other people by working the cognitive dissonance pattern on them. The fact that I'm licensed to do what God does, and that is to love other human beings, to love them with the same kind of compassion and grace that God loves me, to demonstrate the same kind of concern for them in my life that God demonstrates for me. The fact that I'm licensed to do this does not mean that I get to do more than God does. It doesn't mean that I go out to a man and say, look how I love you. Don't you see how I love you? Don't you see how I'm concerned for you? Don't you see how I want to help you? And he says, no, I won't have it. And I say, you will have it. You will have it. you scurvy rat, or I'll take you by the neck and eat your brains in. God doesn't do that, nor do I. God's system is a system of love that will not violate the dignity of a human being who is created in the image of God. That's what it means to be a human being. It means to have the power to make decisions. It means freedom. And when God authorizes me to be his extension, his branch office, his little Jesus out in the world, he doesn't license me with 007 power to kill. That is not the way that God works. All right, so I write back to the head office one day and I say, God, it didn't work. Here's some people out here that I have witnessed to. I've piped for them and they haven't danced. I've cried with them and they haven't cried. I've laughed with them and they haven't laughed. They won't play charades. If I may use the illustration that Jesus himself used, you see, when Jesus said, oh, you stubborn people. I've tried to play London Bridges with you. I've piped and you won't dance. I've laughed and you won't laugh. I've cried and you won't cry. And I write back and I say, God, look at them. They won't respond. They won't look at the evidence. They won't see what's there in the world. Now can I beat them? Now can I call down thunder? God, let's rattle something around here, see? I'd just as soon be a son of Zebedee once in a while. Let's go out and let's violate their personality. God says, all right, boss. But I'm telling you now it won't work. God says, I know. I've tried it myself. I know. And I say, all right, then God, let's... Off goes the dust from my feet, and away I go. I disassociate myself from these ungodly people. I'll have nothing to do with them. I'll starve them. I'll hate them. That man back in Chicago that killed those 8 nurses. Oh, how I hate him. Oh, how I want to see him strung by the neck, quartered and dismembered, buried beneath the street with a stake beneath through his heart. God says, boy, you've got some growing to do yet. Did I come back and did I destroy you that way? Have I wreaked my vengeance on you because you didn't accept? Is that what you want me to do? You go out and love that guy. Love him. You can hate what he has done if you like, but you love him. Just the way that I continue to love you, you stubborn billy goat, you. Just the way I continue to feed you. Just the way I continue to let my rain fall on you. Just the way I let you exercise the genius of the human mind. Just as with the man who is my son. But God, I can't live with this man. Every time I see him, sparks fly. He draws a sword. Shall I now really fall back and just let him kill me? God, no, I've given you something else. I've also given you the law. I've given you some rules. I've given you another way of relating yourself to other human beings who will not accept God's grace, who will not be totally converted. Now here I must digress for just one moment again and warn you about tomorrow. So that you can get a good night's sleep. I warned you one day, I warn you again. If you take your aspirin tablets, in all the decisions which man must make, there is always this eternal puzzle and conundrum about which way shall I go? Shall I love him or shall I love him? Shall I coerce him or shall I let him retain his full freedom, his full independence, his full image of God and the power to make his decisions without any pressure from me? Shall I carrot the whole thing? Look how good and lovely are the temples of the Lord. Come of your own free will. Or shall I say, it's hard to kick against the pricks. Hard to kick against the pricks, and I'll drive you from behind. You know, when Paul mentions this kicking against the pricks, what he's talking about is the way that they got animals to go. During the time that I was in China and India, I saw the drivers driving the carts with the animals in front, and they use a long stick with a thorn on the end. And if they aren't getting enough miles per gallon, why? That's one way they do it. The other way is to separate all the vertebrae in the tail, and then you hold the tail back there. When you want more speed, it's very hard to kick against the pricks. And I can law, coerce certain types of behavior, but I can never convert the man this way. I can never change him. I can only kill him. Or I can only force him into doing certain things. We've been talking about a dog some this morning. I'd like to have you observe something else about that dog. Most dogs do not smoke pipes. This is not a normal behavior for a dog. I can train a dog to smoke a pipe. I've seen it done. When I have trained him to smoke the pipe by all sorts of treatment and training and conditioning. My wife would say this is operant conditioning. When I've done that, and I can do this to a human being too, you know. You can condition people by making life difficult for them. You can turn on enough heat so that they will behave in almost any way that you want if you've got a controlled circumstance. But when I've taught my dog by stick techniques, by beating him and by withholding his food and by giving him food when he takes a deep puff on the pipe and this kind of thing, till I finally get him to where all I have to do is ring a bell and he runs out and like this and starts smoking a pipe. I have not changed him from a dog into a human being, even though he smokes. He is not a human being. I cannot convert him. I cannot transform him by all the operant conditioning in the world. Because that is a matter of status. It's a matter of what he is, not the way that he behaves. Now, in trying to decide how you make your decision, how you relate to other people, whether it will be done by loving them or whether it will be done by beating them, you've got some mighty tough problems. And I'm going to suggest to you tomorrow that no one of these problems ever runs out to the place where it's pure love or where it's pure coercion, not in our existence. This runs off the scale of finiteness, and it goes out here to a point of absoluteness, to infinity, to where God alone lives, where only God is good, 100%. I'm next, like Ivory's Hope was 99.44, and most other people fall down the scale. But not even Ivory's Hope is pure. Only God is good in this sense. I must ask you to think about that a little bit, and we'll talk about that tomorrow, and this is largely a way of warning. On the other hand, the man who will not accept God's grace, then comes the question of how does this other system work? What is this thing we call law? Law, I don't know what law is. I only teach it, I only argue with other people about it, and I only can give some general descriptions about it, but I'll do that now. Some of them I've already given to you. I've said that some of the jobs which law has to do in our world are basic jobs like settling disputes. You take it to court and you get a judgment or an opinion there rather than fighting about it. Its job is to preserve the peace, it's to resolve these kind of disputes. There are some other jobs which law has to do, which are equally important and maybe a little bit harder to get on top of. For example, the law's job is to protect the weak man, the weak party, from being overrun by the strong one. It guarantees his freedom. It guarantees his liberty. Thus it is that the basic reason for entering into a law arrangement with a nation is to be sure that the nation never gets so strong that they completely run over me. The first job of the Constitution and the statutes is to protect my independence and my freedom, always. And how significant that is will be crystal clear to you tomorrow. Because I will talk some about that then. The other job that I want to talk about now is that it is the job of law. I'm talking about law, the state of Washington, the revised code of Washington, or the revised code of Idaho, California, Montana, or anything of this sort, is to collect all of these diverse interests, all of these conflicts, all of the landlords who are trying to cheat the tenants, and all of the tenants who are trying to cheat the landlords, all of the buyers who are trying to overreach and get a better deal from the sellers, and the sellers are trying to overreach and get a better deal from the buyers, all of the struggle for private advantage, all of the acquisitiveness in life, that is the conflict in life, all of the places where your nose gets in the way of my fist and therefore inhibits my freedom to swing it as I like. Because my liberty to swing my fist stops just exactly where your nose starts. The job of the law is to keep my fist off the end of your nose. The use of my land is limited, and I can't do things on my land which make it impossible for you to live. The job of the law is to protect a man from incursions by others, and also take out of all of this welter of conflicting claims and organize these conflicting claims and demands in such a way that you get a certain amount of net forward movement, a certain amount of gain in society. It moves things forward just a little bit. Law is the great integrating discipline of our society. Here we have all the geniuses who are working in physics, and here we have all the geniuses who are building buildings, and here we have all the geniuses who are putting in better heating systems, and here we've got all the geniuses who are cracking petroleum and making high distillates and things of this sort. And then law comes into this thing and relates all of these people to each other. It integrates them, and it moves things forward by cutting down the friction. That's the job that law has to do here. Now, how do you do that? Well, I've already said to you yesterday, almost ad nauseum, that you never get a legal question unless it is a problem in which you don't know the answer. If you don't have a scientific way of measuring it and weighing it, wrapping litmus paper around it, testing it, if you are in doubt, then you've got to get it resolved. Now, sometimes you guess right, sometimes you guess wrong. But the law gives you a system for putting that thing together and getting a decision, because it's better to move than it is to freeze into immobility and don't do anything, see? There's a fire coming down the river, or down the woods, and I stand here with water and chemicals, and I say, which is better, water or chemicals, to put out the forest fire? I don't know. Maybe if I use water, it'll be the wrong one. It won't be the most efficient job. I can't do anything. I'm immobilized. And so I stand there and get burned to death. It would be much better to grab the bucket of water, less efficient, and throw it on the water. I work harder, but I get the fire out. Frequently in error, but never in doubt. This is the life of Martin Luther. It's the whole story of Luther's experience. As long as he looked at God's law as being an absolute demand, that he had to hit it on the button, or else get black marks, because he thought that God wanted to live with him in a law relationship, Luther simply froze in his monastic cell. He minimized all his contacts. He was afraid to do a thing. And he sat down there thinking, oh, my sins, my sins, my sins. Poor guy had never read 1 Isaiah. He didn't realize that sin is simply estrangement, alienation. Because that's what Isaiah says. It's the only place, Dr. Wolf tells me, in all of Scripture where sin is really defined. And there it's defined as estrangement, alienation. It's a story of my life. I thought that was my idea. Every time I get a good idea, somebody comes along and steals my stuff. And Isaiah lays it out, see? Luther didn't see this. He saw his relationship to God only as one as observing the law. And if he didn't observe the law, whip, 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 damned to hell because you violated my rules. And then one day Luther, the light broke for Luther. Maybe he found 1 Isaiah. I always thought it was Romans. You're working the wrong book all the time. And Luther saw it, you see. He got the idea that it's God's grace that relates me to him. I am the son of God as status. It isn't dependent upon my behavior. Alienation is a matter of being united in the status. Yeah, I mean sin or alienation is this disunity. It's a problem of state. It's not a problem of behavior. Having seen that, Luther simply became a civil rights movement on roller skates. Out of the monastery he goes, you see. Out to where he can become effective. Working, spreading, writing, teaching, marrying. In error? Sure. Luther broke rules every once in a while. Frequently in error. Not in doubt. It is God's will that I be active. It is God's will that I make decisions, that I live, that I be yeast, that I be salty, that I be a light, that I permeate. All right, so my batteries are weak this week. It's better to light a candle than it is to curse the darkness. It's better to be out there in the grace of God and in his light being active than to do nothing. Well, so every question that comes up to a judge is a question of what? What shall I do? It's dubious. I don't have enough scientific input to know how to decide this, but I've got to decide. The one luxury the law cannot have is the refusal to decide the case. You must give an answer, even if you don't know what it is. How is a judge to do this, really? He is given rules. The rules say, this is the way that you shall settle this case. You all know that no rule can be so precise that it can hit all the problems. If you had rules that were that precise, that settled all the things, you'd never have lawsuits. It's only in the case when the rule doesn't cover the case clearly that you get a lawsuit. Where reasonable minds can disagree, where the answer is not known, and then you come to the judge and you say, all right, judge, let's see you use the rule on this one. Let's see you make this one come out right. That's why we almost routinely get decisions from appellate courts which go on 5-4 splits of the court or 6-3 or something like that. The court says, obviously this is the law. Five of us think so, the other four don't. Perfectly clear. Perfectly clear. And the next time it comes up, one judge has died and you got a new one. Obviously it's the law, just exactly the other way around. The new guy voted with the other four. Law is method. It's a way of doing something. It's a technique. Law is not a static existing thing. Law doesn't even have a present tense. There isn't any such thing as the law. When you ask me what the rule is, I might say, well, there's the rule. And you say, well, is that the law? And I say, no, that's not the law. The law is the way, the method, the technique by which that rule will be used to decide a conflict. I can tell you what they did with it yesterday. And I can guess with you what they will do with it tomorrow. And as a lawyer, my guess is a little bit better than yours most of the time, but not always. Law doesn't have a present tense at all because it is a dynamic rather than a static thing. All right, so this rule comes up. And the judge says, here's the rule. Now I've got to apply the rule. Law really has three steps in operating. One is to do the factual research to see what the facts were. Who was there? How fast was the car going? Was the person who was hit in the crosswalk? Or did you manage to get him outside? All of these factual things which you come in, and these are just facts. You find the facts. Who knows what the facts are? You decide them. How else do you do it? If there is no evidence, if there is no science, if there are no measurements, you've got to be decided. One guy says, as I was saying yesterday, the car was going 30, the other man says it was going 60. The court says, this is the part I like, don't like, somebody's lying. No, it's, the perceptions are off, and now he must decide. And so he says, the car was going 45 miles. Or he says, you're all lying, and the car was going 80 miles per hour. Or the jury does. The jury is usually the fact finder. It is to the jury that we say, ladies and gentlemen, how fast was that car going? And they go over in the corner of the room, go back and say, 62.5 miles. That then is the facts for that decision, for that lawsuit, for that case. Those are the facts. No matter how fast it was really scientifically on a speedometer going down the road. It's the ball and the strike illustration that I used yesterday. When the umpire, who is the guy who gets to say, looks even though he had dirt in his eyes and was rubbing in his head, and all he heard was a whack. And it was way out here. And he says, strike, it is a strike. For purposes of law, it is a strike. I don't care what it was physically, scientifically. See, you've got to make that kind of decision. Well, when you've got your facts.
Poor Chalk. The next thing you do is pick out the rule that you have to use.
And then you put the rule on the rule to those facts. Now it's this last step, applying the rule to the facts, that becomes the fascinating one.
Because now the judge says, this isn't just mechanical.
It isn't just a computerized thing. Well, let me illustrate. I have to illustrate, or you will miss, I'm afraid, what I'm saying. We have in this state of Washington, a statute that says that if a man and a woman married to each other have lived their lives, and during their lifetime have not claimed the exemption from debts, which is known as a homestead exemption. You know, you can hide $6,000 worth of your assets from creditors, so it's exempt from the claims of creditors. If they have not claimed an exemption homestead during their lifetime, upon the death of one of the spouses, the surviving spouse may claim as an award, in lieu of the homestead, which they could have had, an award in lieu of homestead, in the value of, I think it's currently $10,000. The statute says, husband and wife, not having claimed an award and a homestead during their life, surviving spouse may claim an award in lieu of homestead. Well, the first case that came up on this thing was a man who was a widower. He had an 18-year-old imbecile son, completely dependent upon his father for support. Will never be able to survive outside of an institution. The man was 55 years of age. Modest circumstances, only had a few $1,000s. He was lonely. He wrote back to Strawberry Point, Iowa, or wherever it was, to the Lonely Hearts Club, and he met a gal that looked just like she was made for him. And they arranged the transactions by mail, and she came out to Seattle, got off the King Street Station, were married at noon. The excitement was too much for the man. He died about 2:30 that afternoon. And she was ready to go back to Strawberry Point, Iowa, and it suddenly occurred to him, you know what? I'm a surviving spouse. My husband and I never claimed in a homestead during our life together. I might just as well pick up $10,000 out of this man's estate. The guardian for the imbecile son rushed into the court and said, Your Honor, you certainly aren't going to give a woman who was a wife for less than a couple hours all of this man's assets and leave this poor kid, his illegitimate son, deprived forever. Are you? That's so harsh. And the court said, well, statute. The law says, the rule says, married, they were married. No homestead during their life, no homestead claim during their life. Surviving spouse, surviving spouse. Get an award in lieu of homestead, she gets the award in lieu of homestead. If you don't like that, if the law is too hard for you, go down and talk to the legislature and get a change. Incidentally, they did. But that's one way of modification, is by legislation. You got that case in mind? No. Man is married to a woman in the state of Washington. They are having some difficulties, having some arguments, so he picked up an axe and split her down the middle. Having done this, he was tried for murder, and they found that he was guilty of murder and sent him to prison to live there. He had no money. It suddenly occurred to him that he was a surviving spouse. His life estate had money. He could use some money. So he wrote out the petition for an award in lieu of homestead, took it in, and the attorney for the wife's estate came in and said, Your Honor, well, I'm going to give that guy the money from his wife's estate, aren't you? And the husband's attorney, the surviving spouse's attorney, said, married, no homestead claim during life, surviving spouse, petition for an award in lieu of homestead. You deprive helpless 18-year-old imbecile kids. You said that if you don't like the harshness and technicality of the statute, go down and talk to the legislature. Give me my money. The court said, well, no. Because The legislature never meant that. That isn't what they meant to say. When they said surviving spouse, they meant different things. Do you see what's going on when you violate the technical provision of this thing in order to try and express something which could be known as mercy or grace? And the judge is caught in this horrible conflict of trying to do what's right under the law and do what's right in human relationships. There is this eternal conflict that drags him toward predictability. The rule is the rule is the rule, and we never violate it. You can always tell where we are. The law is predictable. You can bank on this. It's been that way for 500 years, and it'll be that way for 500 years. That's one great big pull that he has. The other pull is, help! You don't mean it that he gets the money down there. It isn't right. It isn't equitable. It isn't just. Do something about it. Adjust it. It's very important that you be able to know what the court's going to do next time. When next time you make a 99-year lease or buy a house, you want to know what the rules are so that you know where you stand. When you set up a trust for your grandchildren, you'd like to think that it's going to last for a while. You'd like to think that the rule governs man's conduct. It's very important to know that our judges are going to do justice, that they're going to treat the widow and the orphan with kindness and compassion. It's very important that there be flexibility so that you aren't hamstrung and stultified by the technicalities of the law. Very important, very important, diametrically opposed. No wonder judges sit up there and rip their hair and say, I'm side. I'll go back in my room and flip a coin. And I'll announce my result. But they don't. Because inside of this rule, there is built-in flexibility. My wife and I live in a very ordinary house down in Seattle. It has a very ordinary living room. It has a floor and ceilings and windows, walls. When my wife and I live in that room, which is the wall, which is the outside perimeter of what is permissible, we give it a certain character. We do. My wife's taste in furnishings runs sort of to the early American miscellaneous. We have things around, sort of state of disarray. That room looks like us. One day my wife and I sell this house to you, and you move in. You don't change the door, you don't change the windows, you don't lower the ceiling, you don't move the floor. It's the same room. Only we've moved out all the early American miscellaneous, and you've come in with Scandinavian modern. And when somebody strays into that house a couple days later and looks at that room, they go, it's a totally different room. It isn't a totally different room. It's just that totally different people with totally different furniture live there. And it's taken on a whole new character. It's got that much flexibility. It's got that much adjustment. That much manipulating space inside of the absolute boundaries. Law provides here in this coercive system the absolute perimeter. The rule says that beyond this you can't go. But Judge A and Judge B, early American and Scandinavian modern, can do mighty different things inside of those permissible limits. But the judge must be bound. He must be predictable within these limits. He can be flexible inside, all over the place. And it is this integrating, systematizing force that moves the law forward in our day-to-day routine decisions. Now we're going to have to go, but you can't go until I give you 3 more jewels. Because you got to have these or else you'll go away hamstrung to think about this tonight. When the law has made its decision, made its judgment, made its determination about what it's going to do in this case, then it can do it. I mean, it can implement it. It can go out and get it done. Justice Holmes, who is well respected by many people, not by me, incidentally, Justice Holmes said that there isn't any law in the world except the law that finally finds its enforcement by a billy club, policeman's billy club force, this kind of thing, you see, actually squeezing people into doing what they have to do. Well, how does the law get its decision implemented out into life? Only three ways. There are only three things that a court can do. One, declare facts. People come into court and say, he thinks that his property runs over there, and I think my property runs over there. And they overlap each other. Where is the boundary line? And the court goes out and looks like this, and it looks around for a while, and pretty soon it says, there is the line. It declares the fact. No matter what it was before, the court has now declared the fact, and that's the way that it is, because the court has that kind of power. We give it that kind of power. The umpire stands back there and he says, that one was a ball. No matter what it was, that's what it is, because he has declared the fact. And when the fact is known, even though it's wrong, when the fact is now known and therefore is legally right, the guy throws down his bat, spits on the ground, and walks away because he struck out on four successive balls. Three successive balls, you see? You declare the fact and things happen. You draw the line, declare that's the property line, and things happen. Now he only plants his garden there and his weeds grow over there because that's now established. Well, the other one is to change the status. Now, that's a good one to go home on. Let's do the other one. Order something done. Order something to be done or not to be done,
which is the kind of law that you hear about mostly. You go out and pay him $50. Or you go out and tear down your fence. Do something else. Remove a obstruction or do something else. Order something done or not done. The injunctions. You guys working for the airline, no, you go back and get to work. I ordered you. Well, if you don't, you see, I'm going to put you in prison. Contempt of court. If you don't live up to this declaration of fact, I'm going to put you in prison.
That's true. So order something to be done. And the third one is the one that I want you to see mostly right now. Change the status. Change the status.
Because the law in its own little way over here, in order to implement its decisions in life, can also change statuses. Do you have a right to inherit from me? Oh. You aren't my child. Suppose that I adopt you. Do you have a right to inherit from me? Sure. Why? You're my child. Do you have a right to half of all the money that I make? No, of course not. We're not in a community property relationship. You aren't my wife, except you, dear. Do you have a right to share half of all my income? Sure. Why? I just married you. Now you're my wife. When the status is changed, a divorce is a change of status. An adoption is a change of status. A legitimation is a change of status. When the status is changed, then all of these other things go with it. Beautiful, isn't it? You adopt a child, and therefore the child inherits. Therefore the child has a right to be supported. Therefore the child becomes a citizen of the United States. Therefore the child has a right to collect on your insurance. Therefore you have a right to claim him in your income tax return. Therefore. How did it happen? We simply changed the status. We've been converted. Go have some coffee. Go up, Frank. Come back tomorrow.